You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although many of us think of the 1960s as the decade that brought about the biggest changes in American society, Jeff Madrick argues that it was the 1970s, in particular, the recession and the anti-government feelings that developed as a result of it, that set the stage for what was to come, at least in terms of the economy. In his latest book, Age of Greed, Mr. Madrick looks into how the anti-government attitudes of the 70s eased the way for bankers, economists, and politicians to dismantle the regulations that had governed banking and stemmed corruption since the New Deal. His book is just out from Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Jeff Madrick back to our show today. Hello.
Good to see you, Leonard.
It's interesting that you've written about changes that came about in reaction to the financial troubles in the 1970s when we're in the midst of perhaps even greater financial crisis today.
Yeah, this book is not a book of the moment, but the moment we all think about, today's moment, was a consequence of changes back then, as you've indicated in your introduction. I wanted to write the long view because history of the moment is often requires that long view.
Aren't we seeing a similar kind of anti-government reaction from the Tea Party and from politicians like Sarah Palin and Ron Paul, who've been urging Americans to fight back against taxes and government regulation?
Yeah, I think there's been an extreme reaction, but there are antecedents to that that go well back before the 1970s. And I talk about some of the antecedents going back at least to the 1950s in Age of Greed, some of the ideas that in effect schooled Ronald Reagan or influenced Milton Friedman, who in turn had such enormous influence in the 70s and over the following decades. But yes, the Tea Party, I think, is an American kind of reaction that claims any government destroys our freedom. It's wrong.
What had happened during the 50s? Did the Eisenhower administration anger anti-tax people?
Yes. Eisenhower was considered a liberal by a large number of people. I like to joke, almost all of them in Southern California, but that's not true. It just seems that they were.
Well, the John Birch Society thought that his brother, Milton, was a Soviet agent.
Oh, yeah. The man who started it wrote a book about that. And they were opposed to the interstate highway system. The Taft wing of the Republican Party was quite right-wing and not in favor of Eisenhower.
And the interstate highway system because it was expensive or because it was going to make it easier for people to move from place to place?
You know, I'm never sure of that, but the explicit reason was it was a big federal program. And any federal program in their minds was anathema. Somehow it violated the sanctity of the United States and what it stood for.
So this is a freedom issue.
It was always, you know, for years, anti-government, long before the 1950s, anti-government in America was cloaked in a theme about freedom. Freedom has also been used, and I think correctly, on the other side. We give people freedom by giving them capabilities like education. So I think that the word freedom has been widely abused by the right wing.
Is it your contention that we need more government intervention at times like these rather than less?
Absolutely. And in fact, we've had much more government intervention, not since merely the World War II period, but since the very beginning of the nation that is widely recognized. Even Thomas Jefferson was a regulationist, a strong regulator of property sales, for example. And we've had economic development and interference in the economy. They'd call it interference. Let's call it constructive intervention since the earliest days. And we do need more.
And one of the most fervent regulators was Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican. So what happened to the Republican Party?
It's a great mystery what happened to the Republican Party. Clearly, I think Ronald Reagan happened to the Republican Party, and that's partly what I talk about in the book. These early antecedents who were thought of as wide-eyed, way-out people, like Louis Euler, the anti-tax people who I discuss briefly in the book, came to the fore and started to rise. For a long time, there were moderate Republicans who believed in government, believed government needed to do important things to make America work. And there were somewhat more left-wing Democrats, and they argued. But that right wing, probably due to Ronald Reagan's political talents and success, was given more voice.
But actually, the anti-regulation feelings began before, and we see the dismantling of some of the regulations during the Jimmy Carter presidency, don't we? So it's not just Ronald Reagan. And then they continue under Bill Clinton. So this is a bipartisan thing.
It became a bipartisan thing rather early. I have a chapter about Jimmy Carter, but the lead person, the person who starts it off, is the businessman Walter Wriston, head of First National City Bank, built the bank we all know as Citicorp and now Citigroup. He began the assault on government regulation really in the late 60s, financial regulation and some of the New Deal regulation, and continued into the 1970s. But then things coalesced in the economic crisis you described earlier in the 1970s, and the anti-government, anti-regulation view broadened and set the stage for the Reagan victory. I by no means think Reagan did it on his own, but it set that stage.
Is it an irony? You also write about Sandy Weill, who succeeded him at what is now Citicorp.
Citigroup.
And they were really hit hard by the more recent financial crisis.
They were hit hard. In fact, I think they are – Goldman Sachs gets all the publicity. Citigroup, I think, was the bigger villain. They hid – they didn't know what they were doing often. The right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing. They hid bad assets off the balance sheet. They claimed their leverage was much lower than it was. And they participated at least as aggressively in these malfeasances as did Goldman Sachs. But if there is a movie about this, it begins with Walter Wriston and ends with Sandy Weill, and it is that one institution.
And is it ironic that now we see a lot more Chase banks than we see Citibanks? There was a time when there was a Citibank on every corner.
Well, Walter Wriston did create an extraordinary company from time to time, and then it would get clobbered by his excesses. All those third world debts with the Arab mm-hmm. money, petrodollars.
And then the Mexican crisis.
The Mexican crisis was the culmination of that. And then there was all kinds of excessive lending in real estate and CB radios, commercial paper over the course of his tenure. Occasionally, his company made enormous profits and they expanded aggressively. They were the ones who built the ATM machines. That's why we think of them as ubiquitous.
My listeners have been writing in. Alan asks if you can compare the European safety net that regulates protection of citizens from corporate greed. As an example, she's read that if a company in Scandinavia goes bankrupt, the private pensions of employees are still guaranteed.
I think that Europe has much to teach the U.S. I've written about that in other books in the past. I think the social safety net has been one of the great creations of modern society. There is the competitive side of America, the business side, and there is the cooperative side, the general good, the government side. And they have to be of equal weight. And we started to lose the weight of the cooperative side, and I include the social safety net in that side.
Well, it is interesting that so many people who are horrified by even some of the proposals of the Obama administration say that they're French.
I know.
French is a dirty word.
It's hard to
believe.
And
that's before DSK caused all of that trouble.
The antagonism towards the French is extraordinary. But the French are not the only ones who have a solid and effective social safety net. That doesn't mean they're not expensive. That doesn't mean they can't be better. The French have a very good health care system by any standard, but it's getting more expensive. It's still a lot less expensive than the American public health care system, and they get better outcomes on average.
How does the current economic downturn compare to what we experienced in the 1970s? Isn't it worse today than it was then?
Yes, it's significantly worse than it was, and it's going to be harder to come out of it. It was very confusing then because economists were telling – you know, I've developed a deep skepticism of economists, though I have some economics training myself. But economists were telling everybody in the late 60s and early 70s, we solved the problem of the business cycle. We won't have serious
– And then we had this big recession with the OPEC crisis and all of that.
So we had the simultaneous soaring rate of unemployment and simultaneous soaring rates of inflation. And in effect, America panicked, and they began to accept simplistic views. And I'm very cautious about writing about Milton Friedman, but I think it'll clarify his place in our history for readers. I think he did, by and large, damage America and develop simplistic theories that other economists should have been much more cautious about than they ultimately were.
And he's one of the people you profile in this book, along with Ivan Boesky, Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, Paul Volcker, Michael Milken, Alan Greenspan. There are others, Walter Wriston, you mentioned, Sandy Weill. And maybe we'll get to some of them as the conversation continues. But I frequently seen the situation today compared to the Great Depression. Wasn't the federal government's early intervention instrumental in staving off much greater financial devastation? And should we be reassured that Ben Bernanke is a scholar of the Great Depression?
I don't think we should be so reassured by that. But we should be – the federal government did stave off what could have been a full-fledged, deep, extraordinarily painful depression with political consequences, which we sometimes forget about. It was the Obama stimulus. It was aggressive Federal Reserve policy.
Well, first it was
by
the
Bernanke.
Bush started it.
With TARP.
With TARP, and then Obama came in. Were those both good things?
On balance, they – well, TARP could have been structured in a way that would have much more effectively gotten banks to lend money, especially to those underwater. We haven't solved the mortgage problem. But simultaneous to TARP, the Federal Reserve got very aggressive, guaranteeing all kinds of dangerous markets. TARP did not save America. That recent movie suggested TARP saved America. It was one piece of three, and it was the least. And let's not neglect the Obama stimulus. He's gotten a lot of heat, not least from me. But that stimulus of $900 billion did contribute significantly to avoiding a big depression.
And you cite a study by Alan Blinder and – is it Blinder or Blinder?
Blinder.
And Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's, that estimates that twice as many jobs would have been lost and the GDP would have fallen by 12% rather than the 4% it did fall without government intervention. So why has that been lost in the debate?
I think it's purely political. Yet again, when we saw house prices go down, yet again the Republican right wing said, see, the stimulus failed. I find the argument extremely disingenuous. And Zandi, by the way, the co-author of that study, was McCain's economic consultant. So we're not talking about a guy who's not who's politically way out on the left.
Have the economists who take a different position been falling down on the job? Has Barack Obama been falling down on the job and not pointing this out?
Yes, I think so. I think he's fallen down on the job in many economic areas by not continually declaiming that this worked, that we need more, buying into the budget balancing argument. We're in an extraordinary circumstance. The economy could well be weakening, and everybody in Washington is talking about cutting back government spending, which could assure us another recession and a still further increase in the budget deficit.
Well, another recent study pointed out that all of the things that have caused this soaring budget occurred during the Bush administration, and yet none of the voices we're hearing today we didn't hear a peep from them at that time.
Right. Nobody. The Republicans were not complaining about deficits way back then. They thought tax cuts would save the day.
Dick Cheney said that deficits were good.
But let me point this out, Leonard, because I think the media fails to do so. Those tax cuts under Bush, supported strongly by Alan Greenspan, who is, if anyone, the culprit in this book, if anybody stands out, the biggest culprit in this book, led to the slowest rate of GDP growth between of any expansion 2001 to 2007 from bottom to peak, even before the Great Recession we just had. The slowest rate of GDP growth in the post-World War II history. And they're talking about tax cuts again as if they actually worked.
My guest is Jeff Madrick, whose latest book is Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. It's published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Jeff Madrick, who's a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books, a former economics columnist for the New York Times, and editor of Challenge magazine. He is an adjunct professor of humanities at the Cooper Union and senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and at the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis, which is in the New School. He's the author of a number of books, and his new one is called Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. It's published by Knopf. So, and you mentioned before we went into the break that you consider Alan Greenspan to be the villain of this piece. Well, let's talk about him. He was praised during the Clinton years, and I remember when John McCain was running for president the first time, he said that Mr. Greenspan was so indispensable, if he died, McCain, if elected, would prop up his body and keep him at the, as the head of the Fed.
Predictably, we overpraise people in times of success. The praise given Greenspan, however, led to enormous damage. In many regards, he was lucky. Sometimes he did indeed make the right decision, but basically the Ayn Rand philosophy that government was almost always wrong unless proven otherwise, or always guilty unless proven otherwise, overtook the man. And he more than any other person, allowed financial markets to get way out of hand. Super speculation, lack of leverage, lack of control of fraud. All of this was within his purview, and he did nothing.
Well, the subtitle of your book is The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. So is it your contention that there's an inverse relationship between the success of the financial industry and the health of the economy?
It is my contention that that was the case over the last 40 years. It needn't be that. Of course, the great piece of conventional wisdom is finance is critical to the running of capitalism. Now, there's some serious scholars who say Wall Street's role has always been exaggerated. But Wall Street literally, especially under the stewardship of Alan Greenspan, misallocated our precious resources time and again since the 70s. The loans to South America, the savings and loan investments, which were outrageous in the 1980s, the bad takeovers, the hostile takeovers, most of which did not work out, but were financed by bank debt and leverage buyout, junk bonds that were given tax deductibility. Even Paul Volcker wanted to resist some of that, but he couldn't go against the great march, what turned out to be the great march of history.
Now, you've called this the age of greed. We've had previous ages of greed. And every boom has led to a bust, whether it was during the Gilded Age and the end of the 19th century, whether it was the Roaring Twenties, and we've seen a few others. Do we never learn from this mistake, or is each one so different that we don't see it coming?
One reason I call this an age of greed is we did learn from the mistakes of the 1920s, and we had the New Deal legislation, the creation of the SEC, the Glass-Steagall Act, FDIC insurance, Regulation Q, which regulated interest rates, and on and on. What's so tragic this time is we reversed history. We reversed the lessons of history and undermined both in letter and in spirit those regulations. After those regulations were put in place, we had a long period of relative stability, very rapid economic growth, and very rapid growth in typical wages. We've had very slow growth or no growth in typical wages over this period I call Age of Greed.
And do you think the average American is aware of that? Yeah, I mean, you point that out, and Patrick in the Bronx has written in, Joseph Stiglitz and Paul Krugman have spoken of the increasing disparity between rich and poor in this country.
Yeah.
Is there any, and Patrick asks, is there any chance that the widening gap will be reversed or could be reversed?
Well, it could be reversed, but, you know, it's not even that widening gap of the rich. The rich made money by exploiting what amounted to paper shuffling in America. They did not contribute to the growth of America through productive investment, or they contributed much less than they should have.
So this is not classic capitalism, the capitalism that Marx was even talking about.
I don't think it's – I think it's classic
abuse.
You're
saying this is paper shuffling.
Yeah. Marx eventually talked about finance capitalism and paper shuffling, and we'd run – but this was – this kind of paper shuffling led to lack of productive investment. And as we reduced taxes over this period of age of greed, which contributed to inequality, we did not finance – critical public investments in education, transportation. I think health. People have heard that healthcare, nuke, energy investments. It's quite tragic, frankly. We think history just will just muddle along and be okay and we'll solve our problems. A nation has to come together to solve its problems.
So you're saying that instead of investing in productive things, we just simply were investing in wasteful things in many cases and things that that generated false profits and eventually all fell apart.
Without question. Remember the high-tech fantasies of the late 1990s? The market fell by $3 trillion or something. And then, of course, all the bad housing investment of the 2000s, which we talk about now. But there's all of that misallocation of resources before. That's what this book is about and about the people who brought this to us.
Well, the heading over Joe Nocera's op-ed piece in yesterday's New York Times was The Good Banker. And in it, Mr. Nocera pointed out that the purpose of banking seems to have shifted in recent years from providing a service to making profits for the bank's investors. Has this shift played a major role in the current financial crisis?
Well, Walter Wriston tried to make his company a growth company, like IBM or Xerox. Traditionally, banks had much more modest growth and were much more cautious. So I think the profit-making nature of the banks did indeed contribute to this. But it was more the investment banks like Goldman, Morgan, and so forth, which turned themselves from partnerships where the people who made the decisions could actually lose all their money into corporations where all the onus, all the risk was taken by the shareholders. Why not abuse the system? You get the winnings, they get the losses. And people did abuse the system.
You say Alan Greenspan is kind of the villain of this piece, but you mentioned Milton Friedman. Friedman and Hayek are the economists most cited by the people who you're critical of. So would Milton Friedman, who had such a powerful influence, would his theories be a major source of the trouble?
Yeah. Greenspan is not the only villain. I think Greenspan had the power to change things. Milton Friedman would say that the power of ideas is much more subtle. Sometimes you have an opportunity, and that crisis in the 70s presented an opportunity for his simplistic views to rise and, I think, become popular. So Friedman had enormous influence. He was a skillful man in many respects, but he had an enormous damaging influence, and I think I trace it fairly carefully and make it easy to understand.
Well, how did he wind up going in that direction? He was a very sophisticated economist, Nobel Prize winner.
He almost started out that way. The irony is when he really started out, he was a New Deal man. And his brother-in-law kidded his wife, Rose, that she married a New Deal man. Now, I think there might have been some opportunism in his turn, but I don't like to make ad hominem attacks from the left to the right. After all, he was a young, lower middle class, working class Jewish man at a time when most of those kinds of people with that background became left wingers. And he changed. He was very clever, but he changed in the late 40s, early 50s.
Around the same time that Irving Kristol and Norman Podhoretz and others were changing.
And let me name one other man who changed at that time, Ronald Reagan, who was an even more devout New Dealer than Milton Friedman.
My guest is Jeff Madrick. His latest book, Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present, published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You've given Ronald Reagan a chapter. Was he as important as most people believe in the changes that we've seen since the 1980s?
I think he popularized them. I think he learned from people like Friedman. I think he was, you know, he was called an effective communicator, and he was. He brooked no doubts. President Obama says he learned some lessons from him, I assume, about creating optimism or something. The lesson he should have learned is that Ronald Reagan, once he changed his mind in the late 40s and early 50s, stuck to his guns completely. When politics looked odds against for his view, he still barreled along, and then his moment came. And I think I make this pretty clear. It's a pretty fascinating life story. But, yeah, he popularized the view.
But he also has come to symbolize things that he didn't necessarily represent. For example, an anti-tax attitude when he actually raised taxes when he felt it was necessary. There are a whole bunch of other things that people now claim that he was that he did that he didn't do?
He lowered taxes for the well-off. He raised taxes, I think, on balance. You know, he raised Social Security's taxes, which are regressive. He cut income taxes, which are progressive. People don't know enough about that. He, under him, the U.S. government, the federal budget, did not shrink. He did not shrink government. The federal budget deficit was enormous when he, by historical standards, when he left office, not merely midway. So I think there's an awful lot of mythology about Reagan.
You're right about Proposition 13 in California. To what extent did its passage contribute to the problems that the state is experiencing now? Should we be surprised that Andrew Cuomo wants to cap New York State's taxes?
Well, I don't know about being surprised. He seems to have bigger political ambitions, so that might make sense. In that sense, that strategy might make sense. I'm really disappointed that he wants to do that. It's Proposition 13 not only undermined and probably destroyed the state education system in California, it marked the beginning of a tax revolt in the U.S. There were many people who emulated them. And the irony is Ronald Reagan, when he was governor, tried to get state income taxes cut by a constitution to the amendment. In 1973, Californians voted against that. In 1978, they overwhelmingly voted for Proposition 13. Those are the markers of the change in America, the changing attitude in America. Those few years when unemployment and inflation clobbered the nation and confused and panicked Americans.
You have a chapter called Decade of Deceit in which you write about Sandy Weill, Jack Grubman, Frank Quattrone, Kenneth Lay. But another chapter is devoted to a man named Joe Flom. Many of our listeners won't be familiar with him. Who was he and what role did he play?
Well, he was the brilliant lawyer who, in effect, created the hostile takeover movement. He was the great strategist. He learned it earlier in his life when it was very much thought of as an area that only ne'er-do-wells got into. Companies with bad reputations would take over another company against that company's wishes. He made the hostile corporate takeover legitimate. He taught other lawyers and investment bankers in particular how to do them and do them successfully. And that movement grew enormously. And the consequence, in my view, on average, some were good, most were bad, was a reduction, a lot of pressure to reduce wage costs, labor, the size of the labor, and R&D. There are examples where that didn't happen, but on balance, it was one of the main contributing factors to pressure on wages in America for 40 years.
Which also led to the loss of jobs, the shipping of jobs overseas?
Absolutely. It led to the loss of jobs, and it led to the misuse of productive investment once again. They cost a lot of money and created a lot of billionaires. There were a lot of billionaires created in the 1980s because of those hostile takeovers, and that's what motivated them. And the government was nowhere to be found. One reason Ronald Reagan didn't like Paul Volcker and kind of persuaded him to leave indirectly by lack of praise was that Volcker wanted to regulate those through margin requirements, wanted to regulate the debt on those hostile takeovers. He got no hearing at the Federal Reserve for all that we lionize Volcker today.
You say that the 1970s was when Americans lost their faith in government. Do you think that it's possible for the country to get that faith back?
For me, the primary task Obama had was one, to show Americans that government could work and work well for them and was necessary for them.
That's the hope thing that he was promoting.
That I believe, and that should have been his active, pragmatic priority, and I don't think he did it. We have to show Americans that it can work. We can't just tell them it can work. And that should have been Obama's job, and so far I don't think he's succeeding.
Was it because he just didn't do the job well, or were the cards stacked against him because there were so many people? I remember before he even came to the White House, I was getting emails from people saying he's a communist, he's the Manchurian candidate.
Was he
overwhelmed, or do you think that he also just was unprepared, as some suggested, Hillary Clinton suggested, he was just unprepared for the enormity of the job?
I think he was unprepared to do battle. My sense is, not knowing him, but my sense is he doesn't like battles. My sense is he hasn't talked enough about what achievements he's had. He hasn't talked about the damage that his political opponents will do to America. He's still doing that. He does not like the battle. To do what I suggest, to show that America works, required battle. And can I just promote that I'm going to be speaking about this at Cooper Union Thursday night?
I was going to mention it in a little while.
Sorry I got to it too soon.
But as long as we're talking about praise, your book was named by Publishers Weekly as one of the top 10 books on business and economics for the spring. So I'm assuming that people will be discussing this book. Just one more thing. The word greed, it's one of the seven deadly sins. So should we assume that we're always in an age of greed and that this is something that has to be fought with?
Yes. I think greed rises and falls according to how much we allow it to take control of our lives. It became a culture of greed. It was okay. You talk to these bankers, they're perfectly sincere about their right to make enormous amounts of money, and they make trivial arguments about economic theory and involving economic theory and how they've actually contributed to the American economy. It's nonsense. It's been allowed. Greed, self-interest will fester into greed if left unchecked.
And many of these people don't wind up going to jail, do they?
Well, we're having a big argument about that. I think probably the criminal fraud laws have not caught up to the nature of the beast. The government does not seem so far to be very active about that in pursuing some of these cases. And I'm going to try to write a piece about that soon.
There's a movie in which somebody is impoverished. He was born rich, but he's impoverished, and his father's dying words to him are, sell all the Google stock, it's a loser, buy Enron.
There you go. What can I say? I'm not a forecaster, but a lot of people have made money backing the wrong horse. Wall Street backed Enron big time and created the folly of Enron. And
was that part of that same paper shuffling?
It was absolutely paper shuffling, accounting fraud. It involved Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase. They made enormous loans to this company and lots of other people, some of them smart. It was pretty sad.
Jeff Madrick's latest book is called Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. It's published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Leonard, thanks very much. Good to see you.